noise, his side covered in blood. The noise of mock combat quickly ceased, and the training field went eerily silent. Stefan turned to look at Malakoff, his eyes wide with surprise. Malakoff drew his sword and pointed at the stunned upperclassman. "He tried to kill Kapitan Trevanek! Arrest him!" He could hardly believe the words even as they left his mouth. "And get the fort's doctor down here!" Officers on the sidelines were already ordering their men forward, even as the cadets, armed only with training weapons, backed away. Malakoff turned his sword on Kapitan Kraneski. "You tried to stop me. You knew about this." Kraneski narrowed her eyes, then drew her own sword and attacked with startling alacrity, a viper quick strike, lightly penetrating his power field to hit the armor at his waist. He shook off the glancing blow and lunged forward, ready to cut her down, when the joints of his armor froze. He landed in a heap, barely able to move. "You were clearly unready," Kraneski said regretfully. "We acted to secure the future of Kador, a future run by those who earned what they have. We will achieve our goals eventually." Two nearby cadets tried to grab her, but the Kapitan lashed out expertly with the flat of her sword, sending them reeling away, one with his nose shattered. As Malakoff struggled to stand, Kraneski ran past him and out of his field of vision. He heard shouting, but he could not turn his head far enough to see where she had gone. Malakoff noticed movement through the Kodiak's eyes. Stefan charged toward the machine, even as confused soldiers closed in on him from several directions. They clearly did not understand what had happened, only knowing a skirmish had broken out among students of the Dracaena. Malakoff directed the Kodiak to meet the upperclassman's charge. Stefan raised his chain blade, and the weapon roared to life. It bit deeply into the Jack's armored torso, throwing up a shower of sparks. Malakoff commanded the Kodiak to attack, but the blows were clumsy. The Jack was still hamstrung by imperatives not to harm any exercise participant, and Malakoff had neither the time nor the attention to force its full compliance. Stefan swung his weapon again, nearly striking the Kodiak's head and scoring another deep gouge. "Stefan, enough!" Malakoff shouted as two cadets heaved the warcaster to his feet. "Kraneski's abandoned you. You can't succeed." Stefan's expression had become one of manic determination. "You could have been one of us, Malakoff," he shouted. He brought the cutting blades down with all the power of his man-o-war armor, further shredding the Kodiak's metal hide. The Fort Tulask soldiers had formed a protective knot around Levenid. They advanced slowly on Stefan, but they were armed only with blunderbusses and sidearms, still trying to end the confrontation without a fatality. The other man-o-wars also moved forward, but not quickly enough to intercept Stefan if he made it past Malakoff's Jack. Malakoff sent as much of his will as he could muster into the Kodiak. He was suddenly in two places at once, a crippled suit of armor and an 11-ton warjack. The reality of attacking another person with a machine under his control felt very different from the theory, and he hesitated. Stefan stepped back and chambered another grenade into his launcher. Malakoff gritted his teeth. He had to stop Stefan from taking another shot. The Kodiak's arms came up as if they were Malakoff's own, and then crashed down with brutal force, tearing a deep hole in the heavy man-o-war armor. Stefan screamed and staggered back, blood and steam leaking from the rent in the armor where jagged metal had pushed into his side. Malakoff did not relent. The Jack's next blow knocked Stefan to the ground and pinned his weapon against his chest, crushing both the cutting blades and the grenade launcher's barrel. He ordered the Kodiak to pause, its other fist raised above Stefan's head. "Surrender and answer for your crimes," Malakoff shouted, mustering enough strength to force his obviously sabotaged armor to take a step forward. He felt Stefan try to struggle against the Kodiak's unwavering strength, but even man-o-war armor could not contend with the might of a heavy warjack. A look of peace came over Stefan, and he stopped struggling. Malakoff began to feel the rush of victory, until the injured upperclassman pulled the trigger on his damaged grenade launcher. From the eyes of the Jack, an immediate vantage point he suddenly regretted, Malakoff watched powerless as the explosion blossomed right in front of him, destroying one of the Kodiak's hands and flinging shrapnel in all directions. Most of the soldiers and cadets had backed out of harm's way, but a few went down in the blast, with Stefan at the epicenter of the detonation. Events moved quickly after that. Officers from Fort Tolosque took command of the situation, making sure the wounded retreated and no other would-be assassins were hiding among the cadets. When Malakoff asked what had happened to Kapitan Kurneski, he learned she had slipped away in the general confusion by taking advantage of her rank. Soldiers continued to search for her, but to no immediate result. They had, however, caught a mechanic trying to flee, the same one who had handed Stefan a belt of live ammunition during the training battle. Malakoff was helped out of his armor by his fellow cadets. He didn't need to look at the remains of Stefan's man-o-war. Once was enough. Malakoff stayed close to leaving it in the fort's infirmary. None of the Kapitan's wounds were mortal, for which Malakoff offered thanks. After 2 days, Leavenhead finally became cognizant enough to be briefed on what had transpired. Malakoff told Leavenhead about the free coins, about the involvement of Yulia Kurneski, even about his own role. "I saw them as a means to advancement," he finished. "I never thought they would go so far." "You figured it out in time," Leavenhead said. He groaned and lay back in the infirmary bed, trying to keep weight off his injured side. "I'm thankful for that, at least." He paused for breath. "Kurneski. I still can't believe it. I took classes from her at the Drezina. I'd pay to be there when Section 3 catches up with her." "They must have been the ones who exposed your father," Malakoff said quietly. "Everything was too convenient for it to have happened otherwise. Not even those closest to your father knew what he was doing, and they had the most to gain by exposing him. A week after his trial, and they tried to kill you. They meant to end your line. A training accident, with live ammunition slipped in by mistake." "That's quite a leap," Leavenhead said, a catch in his voice brought on by grief or pain, or both. Malakoff shrugged. "The mechanic your men captured may be able to confirm some of it. If not him, then Kurneski, when she is located. Knowing the truth will be a side benefit of bringing down the free coins." "Yes," Leavenhead said, "but it won't change anything. My father was guilty, no matter who exposed him." The words sounded brittle. The pain beneath him had nothing to do with his injuries. They both lapsed into silence for a few minutes before Leavenhead had the strength to speak again. "You said there were more of them, this group." Malakoff nodded. "Yes, at least 10 more at the Drezina, and in Kursk, and other chapters elsewhere. I've already sent Commandant Azeroff the names of those who serve at the Academy. They have powerful friends, of that much I'm certain. Tracking them down may prove difficult." "If they have as much influence as you believe," Leavenhead said, "they will be dangerous. We'll have to take precautions before you return to the Drezina, in case anyone seeks retribution." "Let them try," Malakoff said. He was angry, but purposeful. "They used me. I'll expose every damn one of them if I can. I intend to keep the sword and armor they gave me, once I ensure that there are no more surprises, of course. If they come for me, I'll turn their gifts on them." Leavenhead laughed weakly. "That'll give them pause, I'm sure." He raised the arm on his good side to clasp Malakoff's hand. "I won't forget what you did for me today, Malakoff. My family won't forget." Malakoff squeezed his friend's hand. "Rest, Leavenhead. I've taxed you too much already." He paused and then added with a smile, "You may be a great prince soon, and when I graduate, I will be a Kovnik. Eventually, I will be premier. Between the two of us, I'm sure we can help maintain the greatness of Kador and its army." "Is that a vow?" Leavenhead asked. He shook his head with a smile and said, "Never surrender your ambition, Andre. I know it will see you through, no matter what your future brings." On a Black Tide, written by Aaron Rudell and read by Mike Ortigo. Part 1. Blackwater. Late Summer, 605 AR. Iakos watched the Scythe limp into port like a great wounded beast. The thick ironwood planks of its hull were shot through in many places, and the ship sat low, too low, in the water. Its main mast was gone. Only a cracked 6-foot stub remained where the massive beam had once stood proud and straight. Rigging and torn sails lay in a tangled snarl on the decks. The ropes had soaked up blood, leaking from dozens of broken bodies, turning them pink so they looked like great heaps of intestines. The paddle wheel and the steam engines that powered it were intact. Otherwise, Aiko's surmised, the scythe would be at the bottom of the Meridius. "That's Bloodbrine's ship," Dasko said, pointing his dirk at the lumbering pirate galleon. "Shot to hell and gone, looks like." Aiko's nodded. "Just like Barrow said. He's headed for our pier." He took a few steps down the pier as the scythe came to a stop, and the few men on her deck cast hawsers to waiting sailors on the pier. Once the ship was moored, its surviving crew began to shuffle down the gangplank. Every one of them bore some injury, mostly deep cuts and bullet wounds, the mark of pistol and cutlass. "That he is," Dasko said. "Barros had good information. That'll earn him a few more coins." Aiko's glanced back at the gang leader, who was now worrying a bit of meat from his teeth with the point of his knife. Behind Dasko, 20 of their best lads waited, clubs and knives in hand. He and Dasko had run the Quay Slayers for the last 5 years. They'd both joined the gang as a means of survival. Aiko's had been forced onto the brutal streets of Blackwater at 11, Dasko at 12. This was the way of things in Quix. Once a child was deemed old enough, he was forced to fend for himself. The only real way to avoid death was to join one of the countless street gangs and learn to be as vicious and cruel as everything else in Blackwater. What remained of the Scythe's crew had now disembarked, and the captain himself, Grievous Bloodbrine, was making his way down the gangplank. Captain Bloodbrine was tall, gaunt, and hollow-cheeked. His clothes, although of fine make, were spattered with blood and scorched, and he cradled one arm against his chest, bloody bandages shrouding the limb completely. Aiko's made his way down the pier, pushing through the line of injured sailors leaving the Scythe. Bloodbrine saw him coming and put his good hand on the heavy pistol shoved into his belt. This was how most people greeted Aiko's, with suspicion and an expectation of violence. Aiko's was large and strong, and he'd earned a reputation as a formidable fighter, relentless, uncompromising, and brutally skilled. He approached the captain slowly, his own weapons, a whaler's harpoon balanced over one shoulder, and a long flensing knife at his hip, at the ready, but not overtly so.
"And who might you be?" Captain Bloodbrine called out. "I am Aiko's, second in the Quay Slayers. You're moored on our pier, Captain."
Bloodbrine smiled.
"Is that so?"
"It is,"
Aiko said.
"But your ship is in bad shape, so we're willing to let you remain here and offer you our protection."
"What would I need protecting from?"
Bloodbrine asked, tapping the butt of his pistol with one finger. Behind the captain, another member of his crew had come down the gangplank. She wore close-fitting leathers and carried a brace of pistols across her chest. She held a gaff pole in both hands, its blade hooked and gleaming. Unlike the other members of the Scythe's crew, this woman bore only superficial signs of combat, torn clothing and a few scrapes. The fact that she was uninjured meant either she'd avoided the fighting, or she was very good at it. By the way she carried herself, Aiko's assumed the latter.
"Aiko's here says we're on his pier, Naira,"
Bloodbrine said as the woman came up beside him.
"What do you think of that?"
Naira stared at Aiko's with cold, appraising eyes, her plain face unreadable.
"Pay him what he wants. Someone has to watch the ship while repairs are made," she said simply,
then pushed past Aiko's.
"My first mate says pay you,"
Bloodbrine said. He smiled sourly.
"But what if I've got 20 fighters waiting in the hold to protect what's mine?"
Aiko's glanced up at the decks of the Scythe and quickly counted 30 bodies. There were likely more in the hold. Bloodbrine was in a bad position and vulnerable. The pirate captains were certainly a notch up on the food chain over the street gangs, but any wounded beast was likely to attract scavengers. Aiko's took the risk, weighing his words carefully to imply the threat.
"You don't, or some of them would be with you now."
We'll make sure the shipwrights do their work without interruption while you fill out your crew.
Bloodbrine grimaced and then spat. He knew his vulnerability was obvious, and in Blackwater that meant he was prey.
How much?
20 gold crowns a day, Iacos replied. I'll take today's payment now. He held out his hand. Bloodbrine shook his head and dug into one of the pouches hanging from his belt. He pulled out a handful of gold coins and shoved them at Iacos, who dropped them into his own pouch.
Good, Iacos said. Have someone here with the next payment tomorrow at the same time. Do you think you could keep them off the ship?
Bloodbrine nodded at something over Iacos' right shoulder. He turned and saw a trio of awful figures moving down the pier. The necrotechs were bulbous, fleshy things upon a tangle of metal, spider-like legs. They moved toward the scythe, a small mob of shambling thralls in their wake. The undead masters of Necromechanica were always on the lookout for fresh supplies. Word had obviously reached them that the scythe was, for the moment, a floating abattoir. Iacos suppressed a shudder as the necrotechs approached. The undead were part of everyday life in Blackwater, but most of the living tried to stay out of their way, lest they, too, be considered raw materials for the flesh foundries. Some in Blackwater saw undeath as a way to accumulate power and rise in station. Certainly the armies and navies of Krix contained powerful undead, not to mention the almost godlike power of the Lich Lords, who controlled everything. To Iacos, though, the thought of surrendering breath and blood for the cold eternity of undeath was abhorrent. Worse yet was that many were thrust upon the path unwillingly, robbed of their free will to serve as mindless and disposable cannon fodder.
No, Iacos said and stepped out of the way of the necrotechs and their thrall servitors. The rotten stink of their passing made his eyes water and his gorge rise. They always take what they want.
Bloodbrine watched the necrotechs clamber aboard his ship, their spidery legs making a dull, metallic clacking noise as they scuttled across the main deck.
The shipwrights will be here tomorrow after they've...
He jerked his head toward his ship.
Taken what they want.
Thralls had already begun to drag the dead from the scythe, leaving bloody smears across the pier. Many of the corpses were in various states of dismemberment, as the necrotechs cut away the burnt and mangled pieces, leaving the choicest bits intact. Iacos nodded, then turned and walked back to Dasko. Bloodbrine remained, watching the necrotechs with a scowl. Iacos felt a twinge of sympathy for the captain, a well-known and powerful pirate now forced to stand by and watch the real power in Blackwater take what it wanted from him.
"What did he say?" Dasko said as Iacos approached. "He agreed, 20 per day,"
Iacos replied. Dasko smiled and rubbed his hands together.
"The lads were hoping for a bit of sport, but I'd just as soon have the money without a fuss. Hand it over."
Iacos dug the coins from his pouch, counted out his cut, and passed the rest to Dasko without a word.
"We talked to a few of Bloodbrine's men as they passed," Dasko said. "He'll be looking for replacements. Their gathering at the Black Hold should be quite a spectacle."
Iacos nodded. Pirate captains looking to replace men lost in battle often announced their intentions and gathered potential recruits into one of the many fighting pits around Blackwater. There, the poor and desperate would fight one another, sometimes to the death, for a chance at a life at sea. Crewing a pirate vessel was not exactly easy work, but the chance to get off Blackwater and at least have the opportunity to amass wealth and prestige was often considered enough to die for. Iacos was no stranger to the fighting pits. He fought regularly, both to earn extra coin and to keep his battle skills honed. His many victories only enhanced his reputation among the Quayslayers and the rival gangs they often battled.
"I'll meet you there,"
Iacos said and walked past Dasko. He turned and looked at the scythe. The ship was swarming with activity as more thralls arrived to cart away the dead. Beyond the ship was the Meridius, its waters stretching to the horizon in a flat, gray expanse. To Iacos, the sea looked like a blank slate, pure and filled with untold possibilities. He turned back to Blackwater, grimaced, and pressed on.
The black hold was packed with bodies and filled with the stink of sweat and cheap grog. The hold was one of the largest and oldest arenas in Blackwater, and it sat below the squalor of the city in a massive natural cavern. Its fighting pit was also quite large, 80 feet long and 40 feet wide.
"Look at those idiots," Dasko said beside Aiko's.
They'd pushed their way to the front, 10 feet from the edge of the pit, and were looking down at some 50 men and women armed with an assortment of makeshift weapons. Real weapons weren't allowed, so the combatants held clubs, belaying pins, even bodos.
"Half are like to get beaten to death, and the other half won't last a month aboard Bloodbrine's ship. Viger and Barros are down there with them, bloody fools."
Aiekos' brows rose at the mention of two of the Quayslayer's better fighters. He quickly scanned the pit and found both. Over 7 feet tall, Barros stood out like a greatsword among daggers. Viger, small, rat-faced, and very, very fast, stood beside him. It was obvious the two planned to fight together rather than against one another. Barros gripped a bodoar, a suitable replacement for the heavy maul he normally carried in combat. Viger had replaced his twin cutlasses for a pair of belaying pins of roughly the same size and weight as his swords.
"They'll be difficult to replace," Dasko said. "Barros especially. For all his strength and size, he's a smart son of a whore."
Aiekos looked across the pit to where the owner of the Black Hold, Haldor Morid, stood with Captain Bloodbrine and his first mate. Haldor was a veteran pirate who had also survived a stint in the Crixian Navy. He was old now, but still ruthless and deadly. Haldor's guards, 6 hulking black ogren, stood around their employer and his guests, keeping the rabble at bay with clubs and drawn daggers.
"You all know why you're here,"
Haldor called out, his deep, scratching voice rising over the din of the crowd. The Black Hold quieted, and a crackle of electric anticipation ran through the throng of cutthroats and gutter rats. The men and women in the pit looked up at Haldor, and Aiekos could almost smell the fear rising from the arena floor.
"So I'll turn this over to Captain Bloodbrine, and he'll fill you in on the necessaries."
All eyes were now on the tall pirate captain, and the only movement in the crowd was the bet-takers gathering their slips and hurrying to turn them in. These recruitment fights were intensely popular in Blackwater, not just among those hoping to earn their place on a pirate crew, but to a veritable sea of moneylenders that stood to make a profit on the rampant betting that sprung up around them.
"I need 20 fighters," Bloodbrine said. "I'm not looking for sailors. Most of you lot don't know port from pox anyway. I need men who know their way around knife, sword, and pistol. If that's you,"
he grinned, revealing straight yellow teeth.
"Show me."
There was silence for a moment, and Aiekos felt the adrenaline thrill of impending battle crash through him and everyone standing in the hold. As he thought it might, the fighting began with Barros and Viger. No one in the fighting pit was a stranger to violence, but none was as intimately familiar with it as the two Quayslayers. Barros, 7 feet of muscle and callous, held a 12-pound bodoar, fully 8 feet long. The thing was far too heavy to be used as a weapon by most, but Barros swung it like it was made of paper and glue. Seconds after Bloodbrine's announcement, the massive ganger turned, brought his oar up in a two-handed grip, and cracked the skull of a swarthy shard standing behind him. Every set of eyes in the hold watched the shard's body fall. Then the entire pit erupted into a sea of violence.
"Ha!" Dasko cheered. "Not exactly subtle, our Barros."
Aiko said nothing, but watched intently as Barros and Viger began carving their way through the tangle of cutthroats and ruffians, shattering limbs and cracking skulls. They had a good system. Barros swung his oar in a wide arc, dropping men like slaughtered cattle, while Viger waited patiently beside him. Any man that made it past Barros's reach found himself facing Viger's twin clubs. Aiekos turned his attention to Bloodbrine. The captain and his first mate were standing very close to one another, talking intently. Bloodbrine pointed and nodded, and Aiekos knew instantly what he was pointing at. Barros and Viger were making a strong case to join Bloodbrine's crew.
"Those two," the captain called out. "Tall one and two sticks."
In response, two burly, black Ogryn, armed with shields and boarding axes, hopped down into the arena and began making their way toward Barros and Vigar, likely to escort the first of Bloodbrine's chosen from the melee. The crowd was getting wilder as combatants fell stunned, unconscious, and in a few cases quite dead. Cheers and catcalls filled the hold, and the bet-takers wove through the packed bodies like a score of hungry rats. A few more fighters were chosen by Bloodbrine and escorted from the pit by the hold's Ogryn. Watching the battle filled Iacos with a sensation he hadn't felt in years. Excitement, surely. Battle always brought his blood up. But there was something else. The promise of what he'd been lacking among the Quay Slayers. He'd been second in command of the gang for years, but in recent months he had resented it, and Dasko's orders, more and more. Had Dasko done anything to deserve his respect, it might have been different. He had begun to think about killing Dasko and taking control. The main reason he hadn't yet was that there was no challenge to it, and once he was in control it wouldn't matter. He'd become the leader of the Quay Slayers, but nothing would really change. Even the lowest pirate raider had a freedom no gang leader could boast. To steal a life for themselves, as much as their ambition, cunning, and strength allowed. What he saw below was opportunity. He saw a way forward. Iacos's hands balled into fists at his side. He carried only a dagger on his belt, but that could be remedied. He glanced around and saw what he was looking for. A man standing at the edge of the pit had a saber sheathed at his hip. The man wore the red sash and green leathers of another prominent gang in Blackwater, the Blight Knives. The ganger was intent on the fighting below and oblivious to Iacos as he pushed through the crowd behind him. Iacos slid up behind the man and pushed his dagger into the man's kidneys with his left hand as he yanked his victim's saber from its scabbard with his right. The man turned, eyes wide with pain and fear, as he wrenched Iacos' dagger free in a spurt of crimson. Iacos lashed out with a booted foot and kicked the man backward, over the edge of the pit. He followed, leaping over the edge and onto the sand below. Iacos landed, cat-like, in a crouch. His victim had fallen badly. The man lay on his stomach, his neck turned at a ghoulish angle. A ragged cheer went up from the crowd behind Iacos. What he'd done was unexpected and vicious. Always popular in Blackwater.
"What in Torek's name are you doing?"
A shout rose over the din, and Iacos looked back to see Dasko standing at the edge of the pit, his face filled with a mixture of rage and shock.
"What I should have done years ago,"
Iacos shouted back. He turned away from the leader of the Quay Slayers. He won't retain that title for long. It was Iacos that had kept Dasko in power. The gang leader would find a knife in his guts before the week was over. He'd landed in a place where the fighting was thin. Most of it was across the pit, directly beneath where Bloodbrine stood. Iacos raced forward, largely ignoring the small knots of combatants in his path. He was armed with real weapons. They weren't, and most got out of his way. He was prepared to cut down any who didn't. His targets were clear, Barros and Vigar. They had been deemed worthy to join Bloodbrine's crew. He would prove himself worthy by killing one, or both of them. The two former Quay Slayers were standing directly below Bloodbrine. The Black Ogryn escorts hadn't reached them yet, and the other combatants were giving them a wide berth. Vigar saw Iacos first, and the little man's eyes went wide. He shouted something that was lost in the din, but Barros turned in Iacos' direction, bringing his oar around in front of him. There was a man and a woman standing together outside the reach of Barros and Vigar, obviously gauging their chances against the two. They stood in Iacos' path. Despite his saber and dagger, they must have thought him an easier mark than Barros and Vigar. They were both armed with belaying pins, but the woman, lank-haired and hard-featured, clutched a long gutting knife she must have hidden on her person. The crude weapons told Iacos these two were likely fishermen with limited skill in battle. He was right. The fisherman to the right lunged forward with his belaying pin in a clumsy overhand swing. Iacos checked the blow with his saber, slammed a boot into the man's knee, crushing the joint with a satisfying crunch of cartilage, then drove his dagger into the man's throat as he folded forward over the shattered leg. He ripped his dagger free, letting the man fall to the sand, and rushed the second fisherman, the woman with the knife, who was slowly backpedaling as she realized she was grossly overmatched. The woman wasn't paying attention to what was behind her, and had wandered into Barros's reach. The oar coming down on the back of her skull made a hollow thump, and Iakos was splattered with warm, red wetness. He didn't bother to wipe the blood from his face, and stepped forward over the twitching body of the fisherman. The fighting had slowed, and the area around Iakos, Vigor, and Barros had all but emptied. This was a fight no one wanted to miss.
"That's cheating, brother,"
Vigor said, eyeing Iakos's saber and dagger even as he dropped his belaying pin and snatched the fisherman's fallen knife to replace it.
"There's room for all three of us on the scythe, I'm sure."
Barros stood behind Vigor, looming over him, the head of his massive oar dotted with clots of blood, hair, and bits of bone. The giant was silent, and he simply stared at Iakos, his dark eyes intelligent and knowing.
"Maybe,"
Iakos said, and glanced up to where Bloodbrine and his first mate were clearly watching them. Bloodbrine made a shooing motion with his right hand, and the black Ogryn escorts who were approaching stopped some 20 feet from where Iakos stood.
"But I have to prove myself worthy of the scythe, and we both know killing a fisherman isn't enough." "And killing your brothers would be enough, I suppose," Vigor said with a frown. "I was hoping the three of us would board the scythe together, but have it your way."
The little man's right leg lashed out, kicking the sand and sending a plume of grit directly into Iakos's face. Iakos turned his head to keep the sand out of his eyes and cursed himself for getting too close. He heard Barros's heavy footsteps as the man rushed toward him, and he dropped to his belly. The whoosh of the oar passing through the air above him said he'd made the right decision. He rolled forward, slamming his body into Barros's knees. It was like rolling into a stone wall, but the big man staggered back, giving Iakos time to spring to his feet. Barros had already recovered. For all his size, the man was quick. He drew his oar back over his head, obviously intending to smash aside Iakos's defenses with brute strength. Iakos didn't give him the chance. He flipped his dagger up into the air, caught it by the blade, and hurled it at Barros. He couldn't miss such a large target from so close, but he got lucky, and the dagger skewered Barros's throat, the black hilt standing out from the giant ganger's neck. The wound wasn't immediately mortal. Iakos had seen men survive worse, but any man with a knife in his throat is apt to lose his focus. Eyes wide, Barros let the oar fall to the sand and reached up to grab the dagger transfixing his windpipe. Iakos charged, saber leading. He slammed into Barros and rammed the point of his sword up and under the man's ribcage, driving the blade through gut, lungs, and heart. As the blade went in, Barros drew in a choked, bubbling gasp and staggered backward. Iakos yanked the blade free as Barros pulled away. He was still wary of Vigor, although so far the smaller man had done nothing but watch. Barros sank to his knees, one hand fumbling at the dagger in his throat, and the other trying desperately to hold his guts in. He failed on both accounts, and finally pitched over onto his back and lay still. Iakos approached Barros's corpse slowly, watching Vigor. The rat-faced man stood silently 10 paces away. Iakos reached down and pulled his dagger free from Barros's throat, flipping it up into a saber grip in his left hand. He then approached Vigor.
"You got lucky with that dagger toss," Vigor said, bringing his club and knife up into a guard position, one held high and the other low. "Barros would have splattered your brains across the sand otherwise."
"Maybe," Iakos conceded, as he began to circle left, away from the knife Vigor held in his right hand. No two-sword fighter was equally skilled with both hands, and Iakos knew Vigor favored his right. But you've been in this business long enough to know that luck's as good as skill sometimes.
"True, but luck won't save you now. I'm better."
"Let's see about that," Iakos said and charged. He made it 3 steps before a single loud report split the air. The bullet kicked up dirt in front of him, stopping him dead in his tracks.
"That's enough,"
Captain Bloodbrine called down and shoved his pistol back into his belt.
"I need both you fools. Now climb out of there."
Iakos took a step back and lowered his weapons a fraction. Across from him, Viger shrugged and did the same.
"Now to get out," Viger said.
Iakos nodded, turned, and saw that the remaining men and women in the pit were closing in, their faces pinched with fear and the hope of still being chosen. Taking down Iakos or Viger would almost guarantee them a place on the scythe. He wasn't worried about Viger for the moment. Captain Bloodbrine had made his desires plain, and neither he nor Viger would jeopardize their position with a pointless duel. Iakos smiled. He hadn't felt so filled with purpose in his entire life, and he wasn't about to lose that feeling. He sprang forward, blades leading. There wasn't enough flesh, blood, and steel on Cain to rob him of what he'd earned. Part 2. The Meridius, Spring, 606 AR. Iakos stood at the scythe's gunwales and stared out over the Meridius, which lay flat and blue and endless. He could do that now without wanting to heave his breakfast into the water. The first month aboard Bloodbrine's ship had been torturous. Seasickness was a thing he'd only heard about, having never left the islands of Crix, and he'd never understood the misery of the condition. Luckily, he wasn't called on to do much while they were underway. He wasn't a sailor, and spent most of his days in his berth with the other boarding skirmishers, many of whom had been taken aboard at the same time as Iakos. His condition had drawn much derision from the scythe's proper crew, but he wasn't so sick that he couldn't beat a man after death. He chose his target well, a junior seaman named Yarrick, that had joined the crew along with Iakos. Yarrick was generally disliked, largely because he had a reputation as a cheat in the frequent card games played by the crew. It made him the perfect choice. Iakos had broken both Yarrick's arms and fractured his jaw after the man had jokingly threatened to push Iakos overboard as he hung over the gunwales, puking. Bloodbrine had been angry, and Iakos had tasted the bosun's lash for his transgressions. Yarrick, unable to work, had been thrown overboard. Dead weight. It had been a worthwhile gamble. The rest of the crew had let him be after that, and he'd finally gotten his sea legs and plenty of opportunity to use them. The scythe had been prowling the Ortic coast for the last 6 months, picking off lone merchant vessels and filling the hold with plunder. Bloodbrine didn't like to sink a ship if he could avoid it, and would generally immobilize his far weaker prey with volleys of chain shot from the scythe's 20-cannon broadside. This was usually enough to shred rigging and splinter the main mast, leaving the target ship dead in the water. This was when Iakos and his fellow skirmishers proved their worth. A disabled ship would be grappled, drawn close, and then Iakos and 20 others, often led by the scythe's first mate, Nyra Bloodbrine, would storm across planks and ladders thrown out to bridge the two vessels. These were never easy fights. The sailors aboard these ships knew they would receive no quarter and fought like cornered rats. Still, it was a chance for Iakos to prove his mettle, and he was always the first over the gunwales. He'd taken to fighting with a shortened whaling harpoon and a cutlass, using the harpoon to pull his enemies close so he could finish them with a thrust from his sword. Iakos had participated in 8 boarding attacks and had killed more men than any of Bloodbrine's skirmishers save one. Viger, his former brother among the Quayslayers, had also taken to the work of a pirate with skill and vigor. Each kill the man tallied, each piece of loot he presented to Captain Bloodbrine, was a thorn in Iakos's gut. That Viger's skill in battle eclipsed his own was insult enough. That he was obviously well-liked by the crew and by the captain was all but intolerable. He couldn't simply kill Viger. The man was skilled and wary, and even in the chaos of battle he would likely sense an attack. Worse yet, Viger had gained the captain's approval, and his death, if it were linked to Iakos, could have serious repercussions. The thought of being bested by Viger gnawed at Iakos, and he turned and scanned the deck for his nemesis. The former Quayslayer sat on a pile of rope and was sharpening one of his cutlasses with slow, methodical movements. The rasp of stone on steel was audible over the din of the waves and crew, and it scratched at Iakos's nerves. Viger must have sensed Iakos staring at him, and he looked up and smiled. Viger was an ugly man with pinched features and small, deep-set eyes. His smile showcased a mouthful of very white teeth, some of which he'd filed into points, enhancing his verminous appearance.
"Good fight, that last ship, eh, brother?"
Viger said and sheathed his newly sharpened cutlass. Viger still insisted on calling Iacos brother, as if they were still in the Quayslayers. It was yet another thing he hated about the man.
"Yes, it was," Iacos said.
He picked up his harpoon from where it sat against the gunwales and crossed the deck.
"You fought well."
The compliment tasted like poison on his tongue, but it was true. Viger was one of the deadliest men with a blade he'd ever met. Viger stood, still smiling. The little man's head barely reached the center of Iacos's broad chest.
"You as well," he said. "Just like in Blackwater, we were the best of them. We still are."
Iacos frowned. He couldn't tell if Viger was being sincere. It didn't matter. Iacos wasn't looking for friends, and he wasn't looking for allies unlikely to help him rise above his current station. Viger was simply a problem that wanted fixing, an obstacle to be overcome, whether the little man realized it or not.
"Ship astern!"
came a sudden cry from above. Iacos looked up to where the seaman stationed in the crow's nest atop the main mast was pointing out over the sea. Many of the crew rushed to the poop deck to get a better look at the ship behind the scythe. Iacos, curious as well, shouldered his way through the crowd of sailors to get a better view. Viger followed. Captain Bloodbrine stood against the ship's railing with his daughter and first mate Nyra beside him. He was looking through a brass spyglass, a deep frown on his face.
"Black ship," Nyra said, one hand on the pistol on her hip.
"Aye,"
the captain said.
"A big one."
A chorus of whispers broke through the ranks of sailors on the poop deck. Black ships were the largest and most heavily armed ships used by the Crixian Navy. It was said they were the former vessels of the dreaded Orgoth, and enchanted with their black magic. There were tales of black ships that could create fog, call down the winds to fill their sails, even disappear from sight. Worse yet, they were often captained by those who had the Lich Lord's favor.
"Shut your bloody mouths!"
Nyra turned and bellowed at the crew.
"Back to work, now!"
The poop deck cleared of sailors in moments, leaving only Bloodbrine, Nyra, Iacos, and Viger. Nyra glared at the two skirmishers but said nothing and turned back to the captain.
"Do we run?"
"Ha!"
Bloodbrine spat.
"Run where? You see the smoke coming off that thing? It's got two paddle wheels and is running at full sails against the wind. She'd catch us easily."
"Then what do we do?"
Nyra said.
"We stay right here and see what she wants,"
the captain said with a shrug.
"And what if that's to take what's in our hold?"
Aiko said, drawing another glare from Nyra. The captain, however, turned and gave Aiko's a sickly grin.
"Then she takes it, and we hope she doesn't send us to the bottom of the Meridius just for spite."
Morbid Angel was the biggest ship Aiko's had ever seen, an onyx-hulled leviathan bristling with cannons. It completely dwarfed the scythe. As the huge ship pulled alongside, its black sails blotted out the sun and cast Captain Bloodbrine's vessel into deep shadow. Thick smoke that smelled of death, the stench of burning necrotite, belched from the black ship's stacks, and its twin paddles churned the sea into white froth. Captain Bloodbrine had been right. There was nowhere to run, no possible way this mammoth ship would not find and destroy them. The captain stood on deck, dressed in his finest coat, hat, and boots. They looked like they hadn't been worn in decades. Nyra stood beside him, along with most of his officers. The captain had ordered his crew to stand behind them in full battle dress to meet the captain of the Morbid Angel. It was clear Captain Bloodbrine recognized the black ship, as did many of the crew. Iacos had heard tales of black ships commandeering Crixian pirate vessels to aid them in their inscrutable goals. There were also tales of black ship captains simply boarding ships, taking what they wanted, and then killing the crew and turning them all into undead thralls. It was clear Scythe was going to be boarded. What wasn't clear was whether that boarding would be a civilized meeting or a bloodbath.
The Black Ship hadn't fired on them, and its crew was visible on the deck, scores of sailors and skirmishers, as well as the crab-like iron bodies of Bonejacks and Helljacks. The sight of these machines stirred something within Aiko's. He'd never seen one up close, and he was intensely curious about how they operated, how they were controlled. He had heard rumors they enjoyed killing for its own sake, but did they actually think for themselves? He secretly hoped at least one would be among the boarding party. A heavy boarding ramp was lowered from the Morbid Angel's deck to the scythes, and Captain Bloodbrine ordered a handful of sailors to secure it to the deck. He was obviously betting on the boarding party having something else in mind besides seizing his ship and killing his crew. The boarding ramp stood empty for a moment, the iron and wood bridge creaking loudly as the two ships it connected rose and fell with the waves. Then a tall figure appeared and began moving down the ramp.
Axiara Wraithblade.
Aiko's heard Nyra, who was standing directly in front of him, whisper to her father. The captain nodded but said nothing. The name of Admiral Axiara Wraithblade was well known to any Crixian pirate. A powerful and ruthless Atixis warrior, Wraithblade commanded the entire raider fleet in the name of the Dragon Father. She was both a skilled naval captain and a ruthless sea pirate in her own right. Axiara came down the boarding ramp, followed by a pair of hulking black ogren, each armed with a formidable blunderbuss and boarding axe. Behind these two brutes came a pair of bone jacks, their tusked, skeletal heads marking them as death rippers. The bone jacks were following the shouted commands of a human man behind them, a jack marshal. Finally, a score of Axiara's skirmishers followed the bone jacks. Each had the look of a seasoned fighter, and Aiko's knew that if it came to blood, these cutthroats alone could likely kill most of Bloodbrine's men by themselves, to say nothing of the Ogryn, the Bone Jacks, or Axiara herself. The Admiral stepped off the boarding ramp and onto the main deck of the Scythe. She wore a short black coat with polished silver buttons, gray trousers, high black boots, and a loose muslin shirt. Her face was long, with thin lips, high cheekbones, and large almond-shaped eyes the color of freshly spilled blood. A pair of spiraling horns rose from Axiara's head, sweeping backward, and adding a full foot and a half to her already impressive height. She was armed with a straight-bladed sword with a black hilt sheathed at her waist, and a heavy pistol on her left hip, its wooden butt covered in spiraling green runes.
"Admiral Wraithblade,"
Captain Bloodbrine said. He removed his hat and bowed. The formality looked odd on him.
"I welcome you to the Scythe. I am Captain Bloodbrine. How can I be of service?"
Axiara glanced around the deck and smiled. Her teeth were very white. Aiko's was reminded of a shark's gaping maw just before it bites.
"Captain, I've been told you have a good crew here,"
she said. Her voice was low, scratching, almost strained, as if it were unaccustomed to anything beyond shouting orders and screeching battle cries.
"You have fared well in these waters."
"We have, Admiral," Bloodbrine said. "We're making for Blackwater with a full hold. You're welcome to anything."
"If I wanted what was in your hold, Captain, I already have it,"
Axiara said, cutting him off. Behind her, the two bone jacks shifted their clawed feet on the deck, the green luminance from their furnaces glowing brighter. Aiko's noted their agitation with a thrill of interest. Bloodbrine swallowed and nodded. Aiko's had never seen him like this. The captain was terrified.
"Of course," he said. "How can the Scythe be of service to you?"
Axiara took a step forward, towering over the captain.
"A word, Captain Bloodbrine,"
she said, smiling predatory again.
"In your cabin."
Bloodbrine nodded. It was clear he had absolutely no choice.
"This way, Admiral,"
he said, and moved off toward the poop deck beneath which his small cabin lay. Axiara nodded to the two ogren she'd brought with her and then followed Bloodbrine. Aiko's watched them disappear into the captain's cabin and wondered if Bloodbrine would ever come out again. An hour later, Bloodbrine emerged unscathed from his cabin. Oxiara and her men returned to their ship soon after, and the Scythe was underway again, following behind the Morbid Angel. They had changed course and were headed northeast, back toward the coast of Western Imoran. Bloodbrine hadn't said where they were going. He'd simply ordered the crew to set sail and follow Oxiara's ship. He'd then returned to his cabin, while Nyra made sure his orders were carried out. They soon rendezvoused with two additional pirate ships, both smaller than the Scythe. They had watched Oxiara board each in turn, no doubt giving them the same orders. Follow the Morbid Angel. Both ships had obeyed. What choice did they have? Iacos had heard of both of them, Gutter and Ironwave, although he didn't know their captains or crew. Their change of course and the addition of the two pirate vessels elicited many rumors among the crew of the Scythe, but Iacos paid them little mind. When he went to his berth, he simply ignored their fearful whispering. Oxiara hadn't destroyed them, and she was obviously using them for some purpose. That meant opportunity. If he could somehow gain her notice and prove himself useful to her, she could be a powerful benefactor. Lying in his berth, Iacos listened to the conversations of the other skirmishers around him. They were afraid. He was not. They had nothing to offer but their lives, and to someone like Oxiara, that was hardly a precious commodity. Hours later, the bosun's whistle pulled Iacos from the light sleep he'd drifted into. He was out of his berth, weapons in hand, and on his way to the main deck in minutes. The rest of the skirmishers followed suit. On deck, Iacos found Nyra Bloodbrine waiting for them. She wore a shirt of chain links beneath her long coat and gripped her favorite weapon, a gaff hook with a blade as sharp as a dragon's fang. "I'll be leading you in a combined boarding action with men from Wraithblade's crew," she said without preamble. "You'll fight well, or you'll die." "Boarding action against what?" Viger said. Nyra favored him, and she allowed the question. "We're chasing an Ortic merchant vessel, the Viper, and its escort," she said. "When we find them, Gutter and Ironwave will deal with the escort while we board the Viper, kill the crew, and take what Oxiara wants." "What she wants is the captain of this ship, alive. Understood?" Nods all around. No one was foolish enough to defy the dreaded Satixus Admiral. Iacos looked out over the forecastle and saw the backside of the Morbid Angel some 100 yards ahead. The big ship was moving under sail only, likely so the Scythe could keep up. The Gutter and Ironwave followed behind her. "Wait in the hold until we catch the Ortic ships," Nyra said. "Dismissed." They didn't have to wait long. Shouts from the crow's nest pulled Iacos from his berth and onto the deck. They'd found the Viper and its hulking war galley escort. The Viper was large and looked like a refitted war galley itself. The Ortic war galley was heavy and slow, but well armed. Its cannons soon sounded, belching smoke into the air. Cannonballs fell into the water around the Scythe. Two smashed into her, but at this range they barely made a dent in the hull. Gutter and Ironwave changed course and drove straight at the Ortic war galley, their own cannons firing as they went. The smaller pirate ships had little chance in an open sea battle against their Ortic enemy. They would have to get close and board the war galley if they were to survive. The Scythe and the Morbid Angel moved away from one another so they could come at the Viper from two directions and hit it with two broadsides, one from either side. The Ortic vessel turned toward the Scythe, possibly thinking it could take out the smaller Crixian ship and then escape. Cannons flashed, and the Scythe was enveloped by the broadside. Cannonballs and grapeshot raked the deck, cutting down sailors and splattering gore into the sea. Iacos kept his head down, ducking into the wide stairway leading into the cargo hold. The Scythe survived the fusillade, allowing the Morbid Angel to move into position and blast the Viper with a 40-cannon broadside. Oxiara's cannons had been loaded with grape and chain shot, and Iacos watched the Ortic ship's masts and rigging all but disappear in a hail of smoke and fire. Their prey couldn't run, and it was time for Iacos and his fellow skirmishers to do their work. Gutter and Ironwave had succeeded in grappling the Ortic war galley, but had taken a pounding in the process. Iacos knew Gutter especially was doomed. She sat far too low in the water, and the sea was likely flooding in through her wounds, soon to drag her down to the bottom. Scythe and Morbid Angel pulled alongside the crippled Viper, weathering a few more blasts from her cannons in the process. The cannon fire faded as grappling chains were cast from the Crixian vessels, and the Ortic ship was reeled in and pinned between them. The bosun's whistle sounded, and Iacos bounded up from the hold, Vigor and the rest of the Scythe's fighting men behind him. Nyro was waiting for them as boarding ramps slammed down under the Viper's main deck, and rifle fire from sailors aboard the Scythe and the Morbid Angel picked off enemy sailors, trying to cast them off. Iacos watched as the Morbid Angel deployed a type of boarding ramp called a crow's beak, a massive ramp with armored sides tipped with a 3-foot-long iron spike on its bottom. When the crow's beak came down, the spike slammed through the deck of the Ortic vessel, holding the ramp in place. Iacos saw the coal-black forms of Helljacks surging along the ramp soon after. One of them turned toward him, and he felt something, some connection, just for an instant. It might have been his imagination, but he thought he could feel its eagerness and its hunger for the kill. "Go!" Nyra shouted, waving her gaff-hook toward the Ortic ship. Iacos charged forward, cutlass in his left hand, and his harpoon cocked over his shoulder with his right. He was not armored, relying on speed and ferocity to keep him from harm. Iacos hit the boarding ramp and began moving across it. Vigor was right behind him, then Nyra, then the rest of the fighters. The ramp was some 20 feet long, giving the desperate crew of the Viper time to pepper them with pistol and rifle fire as they crossed. Bullets whizzed by, and Iacos crouched low, moving crab-like toward the enemy ship. Behind him, a muffled scream told him one of the boarding skirmishers had been hit. Hoping it was Vigor, he quickly glanced backward and saw that, to his immense disappointment, the former Quayslayer was still moving behind him. They reached the gunwales of the Ortic vessel, and Iacos sprang up and over. His harpoon skewered the first Ortic sailor he encountered as the man raised a pistol, and he cut down another with his cutlass as he yanked the harpoon from the corpse of the first. Gunfire sounded from all around, and Iacos crouched behind a mass of tangled rigging to get his bearings. Behind him, Vigor, Nyra, and the rest of the skirmishers were storming onto the deck. They'd come aboard amidships on the main deck, slightly closer to the forecastle deck than the stern. Directly across from them, skirmishers, Black Ogryn and a pair of Helljacks had crossed from the Morbid Angel, and were engaging what looked like a large majority of the Viper's fighting crew. It was clear to Iacos that many of the Ortic fighters were hired mercenaries and not mere sailors. They wore light armor, all of a similar type and cut, and their weapons were of good quality. In addition, he saw a pair of buccaneers, warjacks common on mercenary ships, moving swiftly from the forecastle to engage the Helljacks from the Morbid Angel. Vigor moved up beside Iacos. His cutlasses were smeared crimson. Nyra crouched down behind them and waved the rest of the Scythe's skirmishers forward. They moved swiftly across the main deck, breaking into smaller groups of two or three as they encountered enemies. Iacos nodded, but he wasn't ready to move yet. He wanted to see what the Helljacks could do. Both were slayers, towering black machines with metal talons and spiraling horns. Black smoke rose into the air from their stacks, and the Crix light from their furnaces pulsed brighter as they moved to intercept the buccaneers. The smaller warjacks would be no match for Helljacks, but they and a score of the Ortic fighters were keeping the Morbid Angel's boarding party pinned down. Most of the Ortic sailors and mercenaries seemed to be on the quarterdeck or battling the boarding party from the Morbid Angel. The quarterdeck was behind them, and Iacos saw most of the mercenaries there were armed with long rifles. They were picking out targets and firing with impunity, and they seemed to be targeting Axiara's men instead of the Helljacks. One of the Black Ogryn went down under the hail of bullets, and Iacos saw the Slayer's Jack Marshal take one in the arm. The Helljacks would be far less effective without his direct guidance. Nyra was rising, obviously about to rush off and fight her way to the Morbid Angel's men. Iacos reached out to pull her back down again, but found the point of her gaff hook at his throat before he could.
"Wait,"
he said, pushing aside the hooked blade and pointing to the quarterdeck. "Those mercenaries are more of a problem at the moment. If we engage them, the Morbid Angel's men and Helljacks can clear the main deck, while we move up to the poop deck. That's where the captain's likely to be anyway."
The three of us take 10 men?
Vigir said.
That's fool's talk.
Iakos bristled at the admonition but said nothing.
These mercenaries are well armed, but they've likely never seen action like this.
Iakos said.
They'll fall back, and we'll cut them down.
Naira's eyes narrowed.
We can take them, she said. I don't like the idea of Oxiara's men finding what she wants before us.
Vigir glared, but nodded. He would do his old